Then the next lengthens the focal point while it measures your progress. It forces you to go beyond self-imposed limitations, farther than you thought possible. Grumbling, okay. In writing on both sides of the brain, I encourage a form of getting ideas out which I call rapid writing. It means to write fast without stopping to consider, to edit, to rearrange, or critique. Use rapid writing when you cover the page, plowing through objections, mowing down the inner voice that criticizes your every word. Write whatever is on your mind. Tell the truth. It's okay to burn up your rapid writing pages ranting and raving. The Yiddish word for it is kvetching, which is complaining raised to an art form. It feels good to get it out. Kvetching is therapeutic. And the brain has a gift for you in store, a reward for your perseverance. I call it writing through to resolution. Because when you keep on writing when you would rather stop, the grunting and grumbling peels back the layers and inevitably turns into a solution and an action plan. Maybe you feel mad when a goal seems stalled, or you are upset about a situation that seems out of your control. Underneath anger is often fear. Writing through to resolution unmasks the fear and then goes on to answer, what comes next? Where do I go from here? Nan's story is a good example of writing through to resolution. She took a predicament that looked hopeless and turned it into something positive. Nan's story. Nan sings in the church choir with me. We are also taking a course together studying the Hindu scriptures from the 5th century BC, the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita emphasizes the importance of meditation, and Nan said in class one day that writing was a kind of meditation for her, especially when she wrote without stopping, writing down whatever came into her head. Later, Nan shared with me how writing through to resolution had helped her through a crisis. Nan works for a brokerage firm. She was distraught when her boss left, and her own job was thrown into question. She knew she was valued as an employee, but it was unclear how his departure would affect the firm and her job. My job depended on him. I did not know who I would be working for or how I would be compensated. 20% of my income came from a direct percentage of his commissions, so a large chunk of my salary walked out the door when he did. Would my duties and responsibilities change? She was asked to write a job description of her work, including the percentage of time she spent on various tasks and how she thought she should be compensated. In the business world, this is known as a desk audit, and for some, it is every bit as dreaded as the IRS variety. It was an overwhelming task. I was angry. I had been at that company for 10 years. Aren't they supposed to tell me what I do? Nan said it was like having to write her own job proposal for a job she already had. It seemed an insurmountable task to account for her hours and efforts to justify what she did. I felt like I was going to explode unless I released my anger. Her husband, David, said to see it as an opportunity, a chance to express what she thought she had to offer, to know how I was an asset. He told her to sit down and write out her thoughts. I wrote for 3 hours. I wrote and I cried. I wrote and I cried. It was painstaking. I wrote first about the anger and frustration. It was full of venom. I wrote down everything that went through my head. I did not censor it. I hate this. I don't want to do it. My heart's not in it. Why do I have to convince people that I've worked with and for almost 10 years what I can do? What do I do? I don't know how to quantify it. I hate this. I hate this. I really hate this. It makes me mad. I don't want to do this. I don't know where to start. I haven't had to write a paper in 20+ years. Ugh! I hate this. God, I won't be flowery here. Please help me figure out what the hell I want to do. I feel like a child, kicking and screaming the whole way. What is it that makes me good at what I do? Am I good at whatever it is that I do? I never thought I'd be in the brokerage business. What expertise do I have? I'm not getting anywhere. What will I write that will be so revealing? Why don't they all go crawl in a corner? I hate this. I really hate this. After pages and pages of virtual pillow pounding, Nan begins to unmask the feeling beneath the anger. Fear. I was scared. I was frozen with fear. It's not that I feared I would lose my job, but I was afraid that I would be diminished. She felt insignificant and small. Her contribution felt worthless. I had a fear of unworthiness, a fear I would be shuffled into oblivion. She did not know who to turn to. Who is on my side? I don't trust anyone. That makes me sad. That makes me afraid. I wonder what they really think. She asks herself what she is most afraid of and comes up with a catalog. I am afraid I don't know how. I am afraid I'll fail. I am afraid I'll look foolish and be thought less of. I am afraid I don't know what I want to do. I am afraid, most of all, that after I've figured it out, I won't be able to deliver. Resolution. Once she had spelled out her worst fears like that, Nan started to calm down. I must be making progress, because I feel less fear and more curiosity than when I began. I remember feeling this way when I had to write the autobiographical statements for college applications. She numbers her fears, and then bolsters her confidence with comebacks to each one. 1. It's not that I don't know how. I just haven't learned yet. 2. I'll fail. Well, better to do something badly than to not have tried at all. 3. I'll look foolish, thought less of. There is always that risk. Build up confidence. 4. I don't know what I want to do. There's an honest statement. Maybe I should just start in the direction where I have the most experience. 5. After I figure it out, I won't be able to deliver. Take it a step at a time to find the holes. Once she worked through the anger and the fear, Nan was free now to answer the question, what do I do? She kept on writing. What I bring to the table is worth the cost. I am good at, not perfect, helping other people get what they want accomplished. I think I listen fairly well. Before she knew what was happening, she had filled 3 pages with her daily, monthly, and annual contributions to the company, and moved immediately on to a compensation plan. I had to get past the anger and through the fear. Thoughts were racing through my mind. Since the pen was already in my hand, I started brainstorming the ballpark figures on paper. I was doing what I thought I could not do. Right from those raw pages, Nan typed up her compensation package. She gave the proposal to her immediate superiors and the president of the company. They were so satisfied that they matched her previous wages. They raised my salary so I was getting at least as much as I had been earning with a commission percentage, and then they gave me a bonus. The endorsement from her superiors was gratifying, but even more satisfying was what writing through to resolution did for Nan personally. It was a learning process and a relief, a validating process for me. From absolute hopelessness, I came through the other end filled with hope and promise. It was good for me to define what I do. I am so busy all the time, and then on to the next thing. I don't stand back and look at all I accomplish. Because she kept at it, kept on writing even when she wanted to stop, she was rewarded with a new appreciation of her own self-worth and her contribution to the company. She put her pen to paper and did not stop. When it was over, she looked at herself differently. She felt like a new woman. Now you. When you have reached an impasse in your goal and you don't think you can go any farther, pick up your pen and write without stopping. Write through to resolution. If you find yourself angry at a turn of events not going your way, chances are, beneath the anger, is fear. Let your writing help you come to the fear. If the situation seems hopeless, and you have exhausted all avenues, so you think, if you know where you want to be and don't have a clue how to get there, my best advice to you is, Cover that page and keep on writing. Cover the page and the next page too. You own that page. Cover it, and while you're at it, go on to the third. You will be surprised at your own power and the solutions you will generate. You will experience a shift in your thinking, a breakthrough in your stuck. Beyond the wine, something is waiting. When you go on instead of give in, you get a sudden burst of energy and often a surprise for going the extra mile. Remember those three little words, keep on writing. The best stuff, the aha, is often right past the place where you think you have run out of ideas or solutions. Almost seamlessly, before you know it, your complaining will shift to a, I suppose I could, and then subtly to a, to do today. Push on, keep on writing, until you come to the pop. In the pop will be a plan that will turn what looked like gray skies into an Edmonds kind of day. 7. Doing it easy. Listing. You need not write volumes to express a goal. A short and simple list of items, as specific as possible, will clarify your intentions as surely as an elaborate description, and perhaps will be even more powerful. My friend Sidney used listing to make sense out of confusion during a particularly trying time in her life. Sidney's story. It had been a rotten year for Sidney. When she found out she had to move, it complicated her life even more. The salvation for her was to use simple listing to define what she could not live without in a new place. When I went to visit Sidney in her new house, I rounded the corner off the busy street and was startled to see the sweep of the sky circling the houses in the quiet cul-de-sac. Sidney lived in the middle house, commanding the best part of the view. She opened the door when I knocked and welcomed me warmly. Everything about her home was inviting. The vista of the water, the clean lines of the architecture, the vaulted ceilings. The place had comfort and class written all over it, much like Sidney herself. A perfect match. Sidney is a registered nurse turned writer and a seminar leader who presents communication workshops. Her first book, Code Red, is an exposé of the medical profession based on her experience of over 17 years in emergency room and coronary care. I was pleased to see Sidney looking so relaxed and calm. She put on some tea and brought out a plate of biscuits. I stepped down into the sunken living room with its plush carpet and settled into the love seat. We sat for just a moment in silence, collecting our thoughts, surrounded by the spacious serenity. The spectacular view of the water seemed to bring its power and placidity right into the living room. Putting down her teacup, Sidney said softly, "I am just coming out of the most harrowing 12 months of my life. I have never been so glad to see a year end." The period she spoke of started out well, with the publication of Code Red. Her elation at having her first book published was dimmed by her disappointment when the publishing company did not follow through on the promised publicity. Sidney took the promotion into her own hands, setting up book signings, sending out mailings, contacting the media. She hand-addressed 2,500 postcards announcing the book, adding a personal note to each. Her efforts paid off. Code Red picked up momentum and began selling well. Then, Sidney received news that the publishers had filed for bankruptcy under Chapter 11. Because her book was a moneymaker for them, they refused to release her from her contract. I was stunned. I had not received any royalty checks yet, and they owed me $18,000. It took me 24 hours to recover enough from the blow to clear my head and call an attorney. 10 days after the news about her publisher, Sidney got a shocking phone call. Her aunt called to tell her that her mother had died unexpectedly of a massive stroke. The last time Sidney had seen her mother was 6 months prior at the funeral of her grandmother, to whom she was close. In less than a year, I had lost both my grandmother and my mother, and then my sister moved far away from me. There was a tremendous void. The publishing saga got worse. Within 3 or 4 weeks after her mother's death, the publishing company converted their bankruptcy to Chapter 7. Before, with Chapter 11, she might at least get partial payment. Now, she wouldn't get anything. In addition, Sydney had already incurred several $1,000s in attorney's fees. Not only did I not make a cent off 3 years of work, it cost me. That's when, to compound her problems, her current living arrangement fell apart, and she needed to find a new place to live. So I had a horrific year, but now I've been in this new place for 3 months, with a view of the Sound overlooking Edmonds and the ferry boat, and I am in heaven. The street I am living on is actually called Paradise Lane. How did she get from there to here? The first thing Sydney did was to think about what it would look like if she and her teenage daughter were able to have a place of their own, even though it seemed unattainable at the time. She had to stop and consider what was most important to her. Since she worked at home, she knew it would help her composure and creativity to have a calming view, as far-reaching as that sounded. For ease and convenience, she wanted the garage to be automatic, so she could push a button and be back in her space. And she hoped not to have to share a bathroom with her teenager. Thinking about these criteria helped her define what she wanted. She took a yellow legal pad and wrote down the essentials, what she had to have, what she was unwilling to live without. 1. 2 bedrooms, one for my daughter, one for me. 2. 2 bathrooms, so we don't run into each other. 3. A garage with an automatic garage door opener. 4. A view of the water. She kept thinking. She thought about her mother, a pack rat who collected things. It took a long time to sift through her papers after she died. That taught Sydney a lesson. She likes clean lines and simplicity, and she also believes that miracles happen in the space of impeccability. She thought about the chaos her life was in. She went back to her list and added, 5. Someplace quiet, beautiful, and pristine. Sydney kept that list in front of her and looked at it whenever she got discouraged, whenever she wondered if she would ever have a place of her own. The money she needed soon became available. 5 months after her mom died, she received an inheritance from her mother's estate. Now was the chance to make her list a reality and find a new place to live. With cash in hand, she bought the Sunday paper on Saturday night and checked the classifieds. There were 4 ads that looked promising. Of those 4, I crossed off 2 immediately after calling and finding out they did not have a view. Sunday morning, I got a call back on the 3rd choice. They had a view of the mountains, a great view of Mount Baker, but I wanted a water view. The 4th ad was short and simple. 2 bedroom, 2 baths, garage, partial view of Puget Sound. I called and made an appointment with the owner. Before I went, I meditated for about 20 minutes, just on nothing. When the meditation was over, I said a quick prayer. God, let something in my life be easy. I need something easy this year. It was love at first sight. I met the landlady, I walked in, and that was it. As soon as I came into the living room and saw the cathedral ceiling, the off-white carpet, the view, and the deck, I knew. I did not even see the bedrooms, and I knew. As soon as Sydney got home, she left a message on the owner's answering machine. Call me. I want it. Not too surprisingly, the owner had some initial reservations because Sydney didn't have a conventional paying job with a regular salary. How did Sydney convince her not to worry? She offered her 2 months' payment up front, authorized a credit check, and gave her a powerful reference, the lawyer who helped her when the publishing company went bankrupt. In spite of the fact that several people were also interested, the landlady chose Sydney as her tenant. Why listing works. Today, Sydney rereads her list of 5 characteristics and looks around herself in disbelief. She got everything on her list, and then some. There is a smile in her voice, then a laugh out loud as she exults, I wrote it down. That's really how I did it. Sydney is convinced that writing that list made all the difference. Writing a list gets it out of your head. Heads can be dark swamps. The conversations, the constant chatter, whatever you want to call it, keep interfering. Writing a list gets it out of the swamp onto paper. You can see a list in black and white, and it's real. When you reduce your goals to a list, it helps keep your focus. This is a truism Sydney learned indirectly from giving seminars. Every time I get up in front of a room, I have a single intention for the session of the seminar. A 3-hour session is formed from one sentence, the intention. Keeping that sentence uppermost in her mind guides her in knowing what to say. In addition, writing a list is a way of clearing your head. According to Sydney, the process of narrowing goals to a list is a matter of sifting through cultural, religious, and social conversations to get at what you want, not what others want for you. When you are vague and general, you are safe. Get to the essence of it. That's when things happen. Nothing can happen when you're generalized and safe. Nothing changes. Throughout the tough times, looking at that list reminded her that something better was waiting, gave her something specific and definite to believe in. Now, Sydney says she has a new motto, do it easy. Before she sits down to pay bills or to work on her new book, when she's picking up the phone to make an important phone call, she first takes a breath and says to herself, do it easy. I've got those three words written down in a couple of different places. Do it easy. All of it. I walked back to my car thinking of Sydney's new motto, trying it on for size in my own life. Behind me, a smiling Sydney waved goodbye from the doorway of her new house on Paradise Lane. Now you. Use listing as an opportunity to crystallize your intent, to learn what matters most to you. Keep that list handy and look at it regularly, especially if you lose heart or feel scared. Emblazon it in your mind. Repeat it to yourself. This is what I want, and it is waiting for me. Think of it as a shopping list. Don't be vague and general. Be specific. Don't simply write car. Specify the type of car with make, model, and mileage. If it's money you want, not just money, but definite dollars. Pretend you are sending someone else to the store, so you want to spell it out to make sure they come back with the right size and brand. State it simply. Do it easy. 8. Focusing on the outcome. Life is like a labyrinth, and the path to successful completion of your goal may be filled with blind alleys and dead ends. How do you keep from losing heart? By focusing on the desired outcome. I sometimes cheat a little when I am doing a maze puzzle. I do it backward. Starting from the exit, I work my way back to the entrance point. For some reason, it's easier that way. You can use this same approach in getting your goals. Start from the destination, and then figure out how to get there. A plane flying from the mainland to Hawaii is, 90% of the time, off course, but it is constantly correcting. The pilot knows he's headed to Hawaii, so when the plane deviates, or the winds throw him off course, he checks his needle and magnetic heading, adjusts, and gets back on track. Eventually, the plane lands on that tiny island in a huge ocean, on exactly the right narrow airstrip. So too with goals. We need to check our compass and remember where we are heading. Hold it in your mind you want a pool. My friend Eric Parse told me this story once when I was discouraged. His friend, Lou Tice, the well-known motivational speaker, told how his children wanted a swimming pool in their backyard. It wasn't in the family budget, but Lou was never one to discourage dreams. He didn't tell them the pool was out of the question. He just kept answering, when they brought it up, hold it in your mind that you want a pool. One day they were all out taking a ride in the car, and they spotted a huge pool above the ground in someone's yard. Just the kind of pool they were looking for. "Dad," they begged, "let's stop and ask them where they got it and how much it cost." Lou was reluctant to knock on a stranger's door, but his kids were so excited, he relented. Can you imagine his shock at the homeowner's response? "We're trying to get rid of that pool. We hardly ever use it, and we want to plant a garden there. Would you like it?" Free of charge, the Tice family now had their pool. The pool story reminds me of the importance of faith. We need to have faith that we will reach our goals. To bolster faith when it flags, write it down as a reality. I was invited to give a workshop in Greece, but as the date neared, it looked as though it would be canceled because not enough people had signed up. That's when Eric told me Lou Tice's story and reminded me, hold it in your mind that you want a pool. The pool was Greece, and the best way to hold it in my mind was by writing about it. I vowed to write about Greece every single day until I got a call saying that the workshop was on. This summer, I plan to be in Greece giving a dynamite workshop to a packed class meeting daily at the Skyros Center on the island of Skyros. I envision people signing up in droves. A real hoot would be if the class filled up so fast that they were turning people away. Using the scenes in the catalog as reference, I could picture exactly what it would look like to be there. I stop a moment to picture the sunny classroom where I am teaching. I am in front of a group of 20 people writing their hearts out, energized and uplifted. I crawl into bed at night feeling satisfied and wake up refreshed and energized to the sound of roosters and donkeys, ready to enjoy fresh melon and yogurt, a morning swim in the Aegean, and yoga on the beach. Still no word from the sponsors of the workshop. I made phone calls, distributed flyers, sent an invitation to register out through the internet. Nothing panned out. I was getting discouraged, losing faith. Every time I faltered, I remembered Eric's expression, "Hold it in your mind that you want a pool," and I kept on writing. I countered any daunting reservations I had with positive emotions. I am getting scared with a little flip-flop in my stomach whenever I think of Greece and pulling it off. But I am clear in my intent to be in Greece this summer, teaching, helping people to feel powerful about their writing and at peace in their souls. I feel a joy surrounding me, a white light spreading out to the participants, as white as the stucco houses shining in the sun against the deep blue sky, against the blue, blue waters of the Aegean. It is a whole and satisfying feeling, and, even more, an exuberant feeling, a feeling of jubilance and celebration. In almost every case, if I kept writing, the discouragement would turn to an action plan or a new visualization. I would follow through on the action and keep on writing. For 46 days, I wrote every day, holding that pool in my mind, and then the phone rang very early one morning with a go-ahead for Greece. The workshop had filled up with people from all over the world. I look back now with incredulity to see how I anticipated in my writing so accurately exactly what it would be like. Moving beyond the outcome. Emphasizing the ending is one thing, but there is a deeper level you can go to, which will steal your resolve further. I call this deeper level the benefit of the benefit, or the outcome of the outcome. Instead of just writing about your target, consider why you want that goal in the first place, how attaining it will enrich your own life or others' lives. To get to this level and beyond, to the levels buried beneath, the outcome of the outcome of the outcome, add to your goal description as you write, and because of that, and then, and because of that. Maria is a barista at a coffee shop called Divas. She is looking for an apartment high in the sky where they allow pets. She wants hardwood floors and lots of windows, and wants it located near a park. Early one Saturday morning, we are alone in the shop, and Maria eagerly shares with me a description she wrote, on a page ripped from a notebook, of her ideal apartment. When I read her wonderful list, I know she will soon have her dream place. because in every instance she wrote not only what she wanted, but why she wanted it. High in the sky, I want the top floor. Pets are allowed, for they bring joy. Hardwood floors, easy to care for. Near a good park, to run in. Surrounded by windows for extra light. I am not at all surprised when, 2 weeks later, Maria comes into Diva's with eyes shining. She found the perfect penthouse apartment with hardwood floors and big windows right near Green Lake, and they let her keep her cat. Sometimes the outcome of the outcome is not as clear and apparent as it was for Maria. You need to let your writing uncover why this goal is so important to you. This is the lesson I learned when I applied for the chance to appear in an opera. I am a great fan of the opera, so I was elated when I heard that the Seattle Opera was looking for supernumeraries, that is, non-singing bit actors, for their production of Puccini's Turandot. I got it into my head that I wanted to be one of those extras. Alas, when I went down to the Seattle Opera studio to be measured for the silent part of Lady Pong, I was all the wrong size. Even though I told them I would gladly gain pounds or lose pounds, they said it was actually a matter of height. I was too tall. They were very sorry, but first, they had a costume ready for that part that did not fit me. And secondly, the tenor they were pairing with me was short. So they turned me away. A chance to appear on stage in an opera was an opportunity too choice to walk away from. I decided that I was going to get that part. So I went home and wrote about being in the opera. It is so wonderful to be in Turandot, and I am so happy. Even as I write that, my heart surges. I feel my chest expand and exhale. I am blissful to be surrounded by music that I love, and a part of something so majestic. I am welcomed and belonging, and the singers smile as they pass me backstage. I mentioned to a close friend how near and yet how far I felt to getting this part. She didn't help much by telling me how many missed opportunities she had when she was working as a model and commercial actor. "That's the way it goes in theater," she said. That was not what I needed to hear. I tried not to dwell on falling into that close call category. Writing in the present tense, as though it were already a given, helped to keep the faith, as weird as it felt at the time to do it. I love wearing a costume and all the little touches, like the curl of the toes on the silk shoes, a dresser to help me get ready and keep all the parts together, a makeup artist to fuss over me, the wig maker adjusting my chignoned hair, all the while my head filled with the magic of it, the shared camaraderie with the others, the sense of belonging, of teamwork, of pulling together. At one point, I made the mistake of calling Paula, the production supervisor, to see if they had found anyone else yet, and she told me there were three other women coming in that afternoon to be measured. I am feeling upset. Now Paula says it is not only the height they are concerned with, but they want under 28 inches for the waist. And there are three other candidates. Drat and double drat. I want that part so bad I can taste it. To combat my discouragement, I went back to writing, and this time I went to the deeper level, the benefit of the benefit, the outcome of the outcome. Uncovering the why beneath the what. Why did I want this part so badly? What could happen because of it? As I wrote out the answer to those questions, I began to understand why it meant so much to me. Being in that production would help my writing. By coloring my world, by surrounding me with beautiful sounds. Watching from behind the scenes how such a great work came together would help my editing and sense of choices. In addition, this particular opera had a special, personal connection which gave me a jolt of joy just to think about. Turandot was the opera I had seen in New York at the Met during the launch of my first book, and I write about the magic of it in my second. I wanted that energy and enchantment to transfer over now to my current project. When I realized that, getting that part took on even greater import and metaphor for me. It became a symbol of what was possible for my third book. I wrote about the outcome of the outcome in the present tense, Picture this. I am under contract with a major publishing house, turning and burning every day at Vivace's, writing my little brains out. What a joy to be doing what I love, working hard on the editing and shaping of these interviews. It feels so productive, so right. Creativity soars. Part of what infuses my spirit in this continual high is the fact that many evenings and an occasional afternoon is spent on the boards of the Seattle Opera House rehearsing for Turandot. As I get on stage or near it, even sitting in the auditorium, my heart goes up a notch, and watching the production come together in bits and pieces informs my writing and my work. What a thrill to go through the stage door, authorized personnel only, to find myself sharing rehearsals with people I admire, as the stage director's voice over the house intercom calls to me, and the music of Puccini swirls around me. The rhythm is reflected in my writing. 2 days after writing about the outcome of the outcome, I got a phone call from the opera. The person who was supposed to take the part couldn't do it, and they needed me to jump in. And yes, immersion in the music and being part of such a grand production did help my writing to flow and enhanced my editing skills. And a bonus is, I got to tell the story here. Now you. Writing about the outcome helps you to stay focused, even when you're not focused, or think you're not. The written word keeps the image steady, unwavering, like a lighthouse beam, steady on. It keeps the goal, the intended consequence, in mind. The page can hold it for you. When you focus on the outcome, write in the present tense, as though you are describing something that is already happening. I call it writing as reality. Be sure to date your description, because when you read it back later, you will have an eerie sense that you wrote it after it took place, rather than before. It will ring that true to what transpired. Now dig deeper. Not just the outcome, but the outcome of the outcome. Don't just write about what you want, but include why you want it. Why does it make a difference whether you have this or not? And then keep going deeper. Why do you want that? And then deeper still, the outcome of that second outcome, and so forth, until you hit the core of it. One way to do this, as you write, to repetitively fill in the blank, and because of that I will, focusing on the outcome and the outcome of the outcome keeps your dream alive. The more you concentrate on the effects your goal will have in your life and in the world, the more dedicated you can be in your mission to achieve it. 9. Changing your environment. Get near water to write. Most of us think writing means sitting at a desk or table with a straight-backed chair, feet firmly planted on the floor, pen held correctly, and paper tilted at just the proper angle. We probably get ideas like this because we associate writing with being at school. But when you are describing your goals, depicting in detail a picture of your perfect plans in execution, or writing through to resolution, it is a fact that creativity often flows more readily when you are outdoors, especially if you are near water. The connection between water and creativity can be documented back at least as far as the 3rd century BC. Archimedes, the mathematician, tired of wrestling with a problem, went to the public baths. There he submerged himself in the warm waters, luxuriating in the calming sensation. He noted abstractly that as he sank, the level of the water rose slightly around him. Suddenly, aha! He had the solution to his scientific inquiry. He had figured out how to measure density through displacement, discovering a method of determining the purity of the gold in King Hiero's crown. Archimedes was so pleased with himself at the revelation, he jumped immediately from the tubs, and they say, ran through the streets of ancient Athens, stark naked, shouting, "Eureka!" That is, "I have found it!" By sinking in the water, Archimedes experienced the physical phenomenon that answered his conundrum. But perhaps it was also the fact that he was relaxing his mind by by being surrounded by soothing water that led to his breakthrough. Being near water, one of the four elements of life, is conducive to creativity. Princeton scholar Julian Jaynes says the greatest scientific and mathematical discoveries happen in the three B's, the bed, the bath, and the bus. The middle B is not just bath, but includes all contact with water, including taking a shower, being on a boat, swimming in a lake, and walking in the rain. In Seattle, we are blessed with gentle rains, plentiful and peaceful falling water, good rain for thinking, and for writing down your thoughts. I carry a waterproof pen and write in the rain paper, a non-porous pad used by surveyors. Furthermore, we are favored with a ferry system that travels back and forth across Puget Sound and plies the waters of the San Juan Islands. Like Edna St. Vincent Millay, who was very tired, very merry, and went back and forth all night on the Staten Island ferry, I have been known to ride for hours, content in the creative solitude this tranquil transport offers me. Several times I have brought one of my children on the ferry with me, particularly when he or she is working on a project or studying for something big. When Peter was preparing for the SAT, we boarded after dinner at 6 and didn't disembark until 10, with a feeling of satisfaction and giant smiles on our faces, 4 solid hours of accomplishment under our respective belts. Of course, the element of no distractions, as well as the rhythmic repetition, aided our productivity. And something more, being near water. Being near water, especially moving water, gets ideas to flow. The particular penchant of moving water to generate creative thought was brought home to me when I mentioned to a workshop group at a holistic center in Boston how people often get inspired in the shower. I told them half-humorously that since enlightenment can hit you in there, it is wise to be prepared with an underwater pen and paper impervious to wetness, or washable crayons to write on the walls. A curly-haired woman in the front row nodded vigorously as I recounted this phenomenon. "It's the negative ions in the water," she contributed cheerfully. This was news to me, so I decided to do some research on it. I was fascinated by what I found. Studies show that people can react with headaches and fatigue when the air is charged with too many positive ions due to such things as modern air conditioning, television transmitters, and seasonal winds. To counteract this, so-called negative air ionizers generate an abundance of electrons in the air, making people more energetic and creative. I passed on this idea of showers and negative ions to an academic group I was addressing in Calgary. A burly Canadian professor approached me at the break. "I know exactly what you mean. My wife is like that," he said stoutly. "Excuse me?" "I say, my wife is like that." "Your wife is like that? I don't understand." "Yeah, so negative in the morning until she has her shower." I did not have the heart to tell him about modern pollution, molecular stability, and artificial ionizers. Then maybe he hit upon something after all. As Archimedes discovered, water cleanses and water soothes, and water restores our own balance. The very sound or even the sight of water falling nearby can calm us down and bring imagination alive. A cosmic sense of humor. When I want to spark my own creativity, I seek out places where I feel comfortable writing, where my ideas flow, and I like a good bean. I have been writing at Espresso Vivace Roasteria on Capitol Hill for years, enjoying the energy, the friendliness of the baristas, and the best brew in Seattle. One day, with a start, I registered an additional, stimulating feature of my environment there. Even though it was obvious, I had sat there for ages without realizing it. Vivace's is housed in an old school building, looking out onto a reservoir, with a tall shooting fountain in the middle of the man-made pond. When I take my seat at a tall counter window, I am surrounded by water, and when I take a break, I often walk around the track that circles the fountain. Here I was, drinking in the negative ions all around me, without even consciously recording that I was doing that. It's nice to know that even when I am not watching out for myself, someone is taking care of me, often with a cosmic sense of humor. One afternoon, I spent 3.5 hours writing at the funky Uptown Espresso in the Queen Anne area near the Opera House. I was plugging away so diligently that it was not until the second hour that I looked up and saw something that made me smile broadly, shake my head, and laugh out loud. Of all the tables at which I might have chosen to work, I had unwittingly positioned myself and my laptop at the one with a revolving heat lamp that mimicked the perpetual falls of Niagara. Unbeknownst to me, the moving picture of tumulting falls had been in continuous motion beside me as I wrote. Creating an environment for creativity. Whatever the rationale behind getting near water, it works. Here are some examples of the principle in practice. A friend of mine had a shower stall built into his office. At first, he claimed it was for nights when he was running late and had a dinner meeting in town. Finally, sheepishly, he admitted the true reason he installed it. For him, it is like a think tank, a place he can go, even in the middle of the day, to work things through, to think things out. A workshop participant who was a diver once told me that he got so many good ideas in the shower that he hung an underwater clipboard in there to record them. You can get one yourself at a dive shop for under $10. Another fellow startled me in class when he reached into his Eddie Bauer backpack and pulled out a pocket negative ion generator that plugs into the cigarette lighter in his car to help him think more creatively when he is driving. And a reporter for the Seattle Times told me that whenever she is stumped, with a deadline looming, to get the creative juices going, she gets up from her desk and takes a jog around downtown Green Lake, bringing her pad and pencil with her. Any of these are practices you can adapt and incorporate into your own life and work situation. To paraphrase Wordsworth's injunction to Michael to get outside, one impulse from a bubbling brook may teach you more of man, of moral evil, and of good than sitting indoors can. Now you. Streams, showers, and waterfalls stimulate creativity. To create aha moments in your life, to capture and expand your insights, for inspiration about the shape of your dreams, get near water, especially moving water, and bring a pen and paper. Eureka! You will soon be shouting. I suggest you put on your clothes before running through the streets with news of your discovery. 10. Scripting your daily life. A day runner runs your life by tracking your appointments, expense accounts, scheduled events, and whatever else you want to include on a calendar that you carry with you. That takes care of your mundane busy work. How about the spiritual side? Is there a type of daily planner that not only reminds you where you need to show up at a certain hour, but also challenges you to become a better person? In short, not just a to-do list, but a to-be one? A performance artist named Ron has just such a system. His is a different, fairly unusual way of using writing to direct his goals and his daily life. Ron's story. Ron and I met at the 3-day novel writing contest, so you might say we ran a marathon together, a literary tour de force. For 3 intense days over Labor Day weekend, we sat at adjacent tables at Vivace's and wrote for 15 to 16 hours a day, with hardly a word exchanged between us until it was over. Ron is a young man of many talents and perfect carriage. It was not surprising to learn later that one of his avenues of creative expression is dance. At the time we first met, he was a student of acting and screenwriting, in the middle of rehearsal for a lead in a chorus line, while converting a novel he wrote into a screenplay. He is an Adonis of compact energy. In speaking to him, you sense the subdued power beneath the skin. If danger arose anywhere in the world, in the middle of your conversation, he might excuse himself politely, and with a wry, somebody's got to do it, smile, jump into the nearest phone booth, and emerge as the Man of Steel, or maybe cross his arms over his chest and morph into a Power Ranger. Currently, Ron is in Texas, taking a heavy load of 21 graduate credits at Texas Women's University. How does he stay so focused, And how does he manage gracefully to cover so much ground in a day? Ron says he does it through his daily list of intentions. Putting the day's intent in writing. I start out every day writing a catalog of reminders to myself, prompts of how I want to approach my life that day. It's a way of connecting to elements which offer significant value in my life. The more I build an awareness of them, the more they will enrich my life. That's why I write them out every day. The first on his list is, I monitor and observe my thoughts, directing them whenever possible. That sentiment helps keep me in the present. Life is lived in the present. When I am lost in thought, I have separated myself from the here and now. The second morning injunction underlines that wisdom. I focus to be here and now through breathing and sensory awareness. Ron writes his list as quickly as possible, attempting to come up with all of them from memory. After the first two, they're not necessarily written in the same order each day. However, he disciplines himself not to go back and look at the entries from the day before, unless he can't come up with the last few. The things I list are reminders to myself of tools, principles, and practices that I want to attune myself to in my daily life. Before, I did these reminders as commands. For example, monitor and observe your thoughts. When I changed them to present tense and first person, they were more direct. I talk less and listen more now, allowing my actions to speak louder than words. I treat every person I meet as the most important person in the world. I feel the power of the universe flowing through me now. People love to give me love and money. Every dollar I spend enriches the universe and returns to me multiplied. Writing out his intent of the principles he wants to guide him throughout his day helps him behave that way, because he is clear in his intent and can correct his course if necessary. Collecting aphorisms. Generally, the maxims and affirmations Ron writes come from his extensive reading, or he composes them to tie in with some new skill he is learning to develop. Or he uncovers, by chance, an expression that resonates for him. For example, one time he heard the philosopher Gene Houston on a radio interview speak of polychromatic time and thought it was a valuable idea. Polychromatic time means that time seems to pass differently based on what you are doing and how involved you are. When you are working at something without any distraction, totally focused, hours may pass, and it seems like a few minutes. You live in eternity and in a moment simultaneously. So now one of the things he writes to himself every morning is, I live in polychromatic time, accelerating the richness of my living. Several items on the list of intentions reflect changing needs in Ron's everyday life. They are maxims to help him stay healthy. I minimize my food portion intake now, eating one-third to one-half less food per meal. When he is in a production, he burns off a lot of calories with strenuous rehearsals. Otherwise, he needs to remember not to eat as much. Another dictum on the list is an incentive to heighten his intellectual and artistic pursuits. I develop a magnificent obsession, knowing that a drop here, a drop there, soon becomes a flood. Ron explains that this particular contribution to his list comes from a friend of his who was at the University of Delaware working on an MFA degree. His painting teacher used that expression to encourage his students to be passionate and willing to work steady. Ron's current magnificent obsession is music. I want to compose original music, even though I do not have a lot of time to devote to it right now. I have been working on music theory, voice, singing, and piano. I do the music theory in the bathroom when I get up, using the kind of book where you cover the right side of the page and put the answers on the left. Bit by bit, it is coming together. I have already finished the first year music theory book, and I am going into the second year book. Combo pop is a phrase Ron uses to describe deliberately doing multiple tasks. I do one task at a time to completion, unless I have planned ahead to combo pop activities. Bruce Lee could be reading a book, watching TV, and doing martial arts all at the same time. Each thing took a different part of his attention, and so he could do three or four things at the same time and do them with integrity to every item. That's what I mean by combo pop activities. Ron is the first to admit he does not combo pop with the intensity of Bruce Lee, but he will, for example, stretch his legs or hamstrings while talking on the phone. If he has not deliberately chosen to do multiple tasks, he concentrates on one job at a time until it is finished. Another sentence in his daily list reflects an underlying philosophy and creed of his. I relax above all fear, living for my spiritual self that knows no fear and knows that the universe provides everything for me now. Saying the universe provides, Ron says, is a way of encompassing many beliefs. When I say the universe, I don't mean extraterrestrial forces. I mean what Maltz talks about in Psycho-Cybernetics. I feed this stuff into my gracious, unconscious mind, and the things that I request, or the things that I desire, begin to appear in my life. People think it's coincidence, but to assume that it is coincidence doesn't give me any influence over it. To consider that circumstances and coincidence can't rule my life is to take out any intention on my part. It credits the fates. I'm a frail craft on the sea of fate, to be washed wherever the currents carry me. A lot of people do believe they're fated, and that things are fated in life. I don't happen to be one of those people. Ron believes it is a matter of being open to things, and letting people know what you are looking to gain. Having the intention and being aware of what you are looking for is significant. Once you are clear about what you want, it seems to me, the universe provides. You attract what you need to you. That's one reason I do the lists and affirmations every morning. It's not coincidence. If you have a desired outcome, you can influence the probabilities. Just like a Peking opera person spinning plates, you can spin the probabilities to increase the chances of a desired outcome becoming an actuality. Go out into the flow of life. A curious adage on his list raises questions. It turns out to be central to his modus operandi. I empty my basket of preferences. The basket of preferences are things he plans to get done that day. By emptying it, he means he is conscious of his calendar, but not bound by it. I go out into the flow of life, allowing new developments to occur. As they do, I respond. The expression is not original with Ron. The lineage of the term goes back to a man I studied martial arts from, who had studied with Bruce Lee. You start out the day noting what you want to get done that day. But don't fill your basket of preferences too full. You might find yourself doing something that is not on your list. If you schedule your whole day, you are not going to have time to do those spontaneous things. When a new development arises that has significant value for me, something that outweighs the value of what I had intended, I will do the new thing. So I go out without being locked into any preferences, and just be with the world and the universe, and respond without any expectations of rewards from other people or from situations. Otherwise, I may be limiting what those situations or people might offer me. If I come in with a preconceived agenda, it's a block. There might be much more I could learn if I was open to whatever possibilities exist or could come out of the interaction. Ron insists that there is a huge distinction between his basket and a time management list. One of the differences is that at the end of the day, he is not beating on himself for what he hasn't done. There's no reason to be guilty, because then I'm violating the very first thing on my list of intentions, monitor my thoughts, and the second, be in the here and now. Guilt is in the past. I want to do everything I can to spend my time and awareness in the here and now, because that's where life is. The bigger I can make the present moment, the richer my life is going to be. I stay open for new developments and opportunities, improvising within a structure of intent. Dropping items from the list of intentions. The purpose of writing out the reminders is to implant them in his mind. Ron has been writing his list for several years.